Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello everybody and welcome to our podcast. So this version of our podcast we're going to dedicate to headache, and I've got Peter with me.
Hello Vicky.
We're really honoured today to have a special guest with us. We've got Anita Krishnan, who's a consultant in neurology working at the Walton Centre in Liverpool, and she has a special interest in headache. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
Thank you so much for giving up your time. This is an incredibly important topic for acute medicine, because this is something that we see time and time again. And I have to say, despite however many years, I still find it challenging at times. How about you, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. It still makes me a bit nervous.
Yeah, when you see a headache and it's 10 o'clock at night, you've been on all day and you're like, oh, no.
Absolutely.
Because I think we were just talking about this before we started the podcast. The problem with headache is that it is all really about the history and your clinical skill, really. And there isn't any magic D-dimer or troponin to help you out. So we've got to be on our game, really, haven't we? So let's just start with a very general question then, Anita. What are your top tips for looking at a patient with a headache, and what are the real red flags that stand out to you?
Sure, I agree. I think a headache is, you know, can be quite a nerve-wracking set of symptoms. It can also sometimes be a heart sink symptom when you get patients, the same patient repeatedly presenting. So I think how I would approach an acute headache consultation. So I think there are two scenarios. There's one wherein you're in an A&E, AMU, and you're seeing somebody with a significant headache who's presented acutely, versus somebody in clinic who's there still with a very troublesome headache, but a bit more chronic. But in both of these things, the first thing I would establish is this a brand new headache, or is this an ongoing headache that's been going on, let's say, for weeks or months, with a worsening? And I think that's very important, because when we look at red flags, if you look at the definition of area of the red flags, it is new headache, so sudden onset like thunderclap, or new headache with features of raised pressure, or new headache with features of infection, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I think the newness of it does matter. Now, this is not as easy as I make it out to be, because if you imagine that 20 to 30% of the world are generally headachy. So the current estimate being, you know, of the 8.5 billion or so people, there's a good few billion who are generally headache sufferers. And then you're trying to delineate how new is this headache? So as you rightly said, it's all going to be on the story. And one of the things that I ask people is, I recognize that your current headache is really bad, but tell me, are you generally a headachy person? So headaches when you're unwell, headaches when you're tired, headaches if you've been on a long, you know, journey, not slept very well, or are headaches a completely brand new thing for you? And that will give me an idea of whether they're generally headachy with a, you know, a worsening type, or they're not very headachy at all, and this is a completely new thing. Mm-hmm. From that, we go on to obviously, you know, talk about red flags. The most crucial red flag to first address and get out of the way is it a thunderclap headache or not? And this can be quite difficult, because most patients, quite understandably, will describe their headache as sudden and severe. Mm-hmm. So the things that we were taught in, or at least I was taught in medical school about, is this the worst headache, or, you know, is the headache like being hit with some sort of instrument in the back of your head, etc. Currently, I don't think holds much relevance in the history taking. You cannot get the story of thunderclap by a one or two questions. And the way I would go about it, I'd ask the patient, so tell me how the headache was when it started. And they'll sort of say, they'll describe the situation. I woke up in the morning, I was getting ready, and then I started off with this headache. And then I'll ask them to grade it. And that's one of the situations where I give the patients the scenario of 0 is no pain, 10 is the worst imaginable pain. Give me a number at, you know, the headache was at the start of it. And then you have to estimate how quickly it built up. And generally for thunderclap, you're looking at a severe grade of headache. So I'm going to use a practical number here, something between 8 and 10 within the first minute or two. So it shouldn't be, I was getting ready, I had a 5 out of 10. By the time I took the kids to school, it became an 8. And when I was coming back, it was a 10 out of 10. Mm. That's more of a gradual bit. But yeah, the patient would still describe that as a very severe and sudden onset.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing about thunderclap. The location doesn't matter. People can have thunderclap headaches in the front of the head, the back of the head, around their neck. So I think that's very crucial. In fact, when I do lectures on headache, one of the things I always advise people is the human head is not just a scalp. It also involves the face. So somebody describing pain around the eye or what patients classify as the sinus area isn't necessarily always sinusitis. Mm. It's it forms a part of headache. And similarly, a significant proportion of patients with severe or chronic headaches will have neck pain. You don't have to look for a separate disorder, mm-hmm. to explain that. So that's thunderclap headache. And then other red flags that I would look for is features of raised intracranial pressure. Again, gone are the days when we use the description of the headache to determine raised intracranial pressure. I think it's very useful for all audiences to understand that the term pressure in language is used very often by all headachy people, whether they are migraineous or whether they actually have it. So you should never go by the patient's use of the term pressure. And because for most patients, quite genuinely, the headache feels like a pressure behind their eyes or a pressure in the back of the head. So we, over the last decade or more, have now been relying very much on eye signs. So specifically asking for true double vision. So as in two split images, not just blurring, or these symptom of visual obscurations where a patient will say, my vision's okay, but if I bend down or if I cough or sneeze, I briefly lose vision in either one eye or both. So it's a graying or blacking out of vision for a few seconds to less than a minute, and then it becomes okay. So somebody will say, I bent down to pick up my child's toy and I briefly lost vision and then it came back. So that syndrome of visual obscurations is something that should, lead things. If you specifically talk about the headache, the specific things that will make you think about raised pressure are headaches that come on coughing, sneezing, or straining. So again, it's useful to point out here that all headaches worsen on coughing, sneezing.
Yeah, I remember listening to you say that in SAM.
Yes.
And it was a game changer because, I've had a headache and then coughed and it got worse.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh no. But actually, that was really helpful.
It has to be brought on. And, the other thing that we always talk about is the, headaches early in the morning, in the middle of the night. Now, this is a bit of a double-edged sword because if you look at it, somebody who is tired or has obstructive sleep apnea might wake up in the morning with a headache and doesn't necessarily mean that there is of course, there is a secondary cause, but it may not be something as sinister as one would imagine. And primary headaches like cluster headache wake you up in the middle of the night. So do migraines. So there is a thing about the internal headache system that we have that sort of wakes up around 4 a.m., 5 a.m. creates headaches. So not all headaches that wake you up in the middle of the night necessarily mean that there's raised pressure. And I think you've got to put that in the context of the situation rather than just go by that as the only means of sort of identifying. So, and then red flags, of course, systemic features. I'm sure your audience will be well aware that somebody who presents with new headaches and features of infection, or there is a background of an ongoing malignancy, etc., you'll have a low threshold for investigating them because you do need to make sure that there isn't a secondary cause. Mm-hmm. And the only other one that I would like to mention is low pressure. So we focus a lot on high pressure. Low CSF pressure sometimes doesn't get the importance or the awareness that it needs. It doesn't always just happen after lumbar punctures or, dural punctures after an epidural that has gone in a bit more than anticipated. Low pressure can happen spontaneously as well when patients leak CSF. And there, it is an interesting headache wherein we call it an orthostatic headache, wherein patients will be symptom-free lying down, totally symptom-free, not I am better lying down, I have no headaches lying down. But on sitting up or standing up, they then develop a very intense, very migraine-like pain, which again gets better when they lie down. So that significant postural one should make you suspect. Again, I have to raise the caveat that just like the coughing, sneezing business, everybody feels better lying down, but that's not the question.
Yeah.
You should be symptom-free lying down.
So I'm going to skip ahead. Sorry, Peter, but now we've mentioned that, that was something I was going to come to, because we do see this a fair bit. So we see it quite a lot in the patients that have had an LP.
Yes.
And I'm always wondering how to investigate them, because it feels like a plain CT is not going to give you any use. So if it's somebody who's got a clear history of the LP, you know, we give some fluids, some IV paracetamol, and some of them get lots better after that.
Right.
But it's the other bits there. So what if it's a spontaneous history? What imaging do we need?
Yeah.
And then also, what if fluids and paracetamol aren't enough? Because on the vague bit of reading I've done, it's controversial. Then I know we can't give IV caffeine because it requires a monitor and that sort of thing and in our trust. So a little bit more advice on how we treat.
Sure. So Lucius, Rasha, just on the point about post-LP headaches, again, it's worthwhile understanding that, you see, when we do lumbar punctures, most of those patients would have already had a headache. That's why you're doing the lumbar puncture, meningitis, you know, queries, whatever. So it is very natural for pre-existing headache to worsen after a lumbar puncture. Doesn't always mean that they all have low pressure.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing. And when we consent patients for lumbar puncture, if they already have a headache, we should always advise them. It is very natural for headaches to get worse. There is no evidence that lying flat after lumbar punctures tends to prevent that. All we tell people is that keep yourself well hydrated. If you have worsening of the headache, you might have to take time off work for a week, which usually brings about groans of, you know, anguish from patients, but, you know,
or delight.
And not take too many painkillers and rest. And, you know, it'll gradually get better. And setting that expectation, I think, is very important because there's this expectation that, oh, I've gone in for the procedure, it should get better quickly.
Yes.
It doesn't.
Yeah,
headache
yeah.
never sort of instantaneously gets better.
Yeah.
So that's the group scenario that you mentioned, that most people with a post-LP headache can worsen, have worsening headache, and they will settle with very simple supportive treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that have true low CSF pressure, you will get that strong postural variation. And the advice, again, as you rightly said, is initially well sort of hydration. That could be oral fluids, but many of them are very sickly, etc. I always point out at this stage that they will not have symptoms if they're lying down. So if somebody with a post-LP headache tells me, I'm terrible, I'll say, you're probably walking around too much. You should be lying down because you wouldn't need the painkillers or the anti-sickness. And if you give the, you know, the system a bit of rest, it will spontaneously work. So hydration, avoid regular painkillers, enforce as much of flat bed rest as possible. And I tell patients for the first 72 hours, you've got to do that. And that 72 hours isn't based on any clear cutoff criteria. It's just practical experience more than anything. And then give yourself time and gradually start mobilizing and see how you are. And still, your headache is probably going to take 10 days to 2 weeks to completely resolve. If, however, you find that a patient is getting progressively worse despite that 72 hours, and that they are getting more headachey, vomiting, people developing other signs like a sixth nerve palsy, it's quite clear that you do have to investigate them. Now, we actually got, you know, there's quite a lot of debate about low CSF pressure, because if you look at it, the primary modality of investigation remains an MR brain.
Mm-hmm.
And in a MR brain, a plain MR brain, so no contrast, the features you're looking for is the secondary features of the low pressure. So when the brain sustains a low pressure situation, the brain then does certain compensatory mechanisms to try and correct that low pressure. And one of the things it does is it creates a bit of a slump. So the brainstem slumps down slightly. it's like a, what, you know, even though I hate using the word pseudo, I might use, it is sometimes termed as a pseudo Chiari in some of the reports. It just resembles a Chiari, but it's a slum. The pituitary becomes a bit engorged. So the brain's trying to increase the venous flow into its system to compensate for the low pressure. And the brain sometimes also creates subdural collections of CSF, subdural hygromas. So that's what we pick up on an MR scan. Mm-hmm. Doing an MR scan with contrast has an added advantage in that you will pick up the feature of meningeal enhancement that happens after low pressure. This meningeal enhancement will be like a uniform. So it's not like an infiltrative meningeal enhancement where you get quite a bit of nodularity. It'll be quite a smooth enhancing sort of meningeal enhancement. Now, you should have, I think, a friendly discussion with your radiologist on what they best, but you're quite right. An MR of the brain and the upper spine to look for the brain slum, pituitary enlargement, any collections of subdural CSF plus meningeal enhancement is what will tell you whether there is active CSF leak going on. Mm-hmm. And if there is active CSF leak and the patient is symptomatically getting worse, that's the time that we would consider the suitability for the patient to have a blood patch.
Yeah.
So an epidural blood patch is where the patient's own blood is sort of injected under very strict aseptic conditions into the epidural space. And contrary to popular belief, I don't think it goes and seals the leak. It actually, again, adjusts the pressure system mm-hmm. by almost creating, we think, a splinting effect of the meningeal system in the spine. Again, this is, you know, subject to a lot of discussion. So that's, we were referring to post-LP, but even in spontaneous, if you get the typical story, many patients with spontaneous also get better without any intervention. Mm-hmm. But if it's progressive symptoms, patient developing, let's say, brainstem symptoms, etc., mm-hmm. you do need to investigate those patients mm-hmm. with an MR brain, upper spine, ideally with contrast, but still understandable if contrast isn't given.
So would you not need to image the rest of the spine? Because surely if you have a dural leak, it could happen anywhere along
the spine. So yes, you can. So if it is a lumbar puncture, post-lumbar puncture, you sort of know the site of the leak. You are looking for secondary supporting features, and we don't necessarily advise for the whole spine to be imaged. But most likely, if you're planning an epidural blood patch, it makes sense for the spine to be imaged. Now, if you're thinking about, can we actually find the site of a leak on an MR scan? Even though we have amazing MR scan systems, the pickup of an active leak on an MR is very, very low.
Right. Okay.
So even sometimes after a lumbar puncture, you might find that there's a bit of a CSF track along where the needle went in, and you're sort of saying, okay, that was probably the most common site of the leak. But if you have a spontaneous leak and you don't find a site of leak, don't be surprised at all. These leaks are very tiny little things. Very often they seal themselves off quite quickly, we think. And what you are then seeing, the effect, the clinical syndrome is not necessarily that there is an ongoing leak. The clinical syndrome comes from the low pressure of the previous leak.
Sure.
So here comes the big question of that in the not question, it's in the issue of the brain, wherein there is hypovolemia initially, and then there is hypotension. And with the ongoing hypotension probably causes the symptoms.
Sure.
So how we then deal with that is even if you've got very good going signs of a CSF leak, even if there's no identifiable site of leak, again, we know from experience that the most common sites you leak from is your cervicothoracic region. And so an experienced anesthetist will go into sort of doing a lumbar approach, put in the epidural blood patch, and, you know, hope for the leak to be, let's say, addressed. Again, you know, I always tell people it's not that I don't think it's going and sealing the leak, but it is sort of addressing the pressure situation. Some people get dramatic improvement after one blood patch. Some people don't. And here comes a bit more of a difficult situation. And I do think that that should be discussed with a neurologist. So at the Walton, how we manage those patients who haven't responded is that we take them through an MDT discussion. We actually evaluate all of the scans. And then the current day thinking is, at that point, you have to start actively searching for a leak with procedures like a myelogram, a CT myelogram or an MR myelogram as such.
Okay. So practically from our point of view, if somebody comes into the acute medical department with features of a low pressure headache, initially, is it reasonable for us to ambulate them, you know, after giving them a bit of fluid, giving them a bit of time, seeing them again? And then at that point, if the symptoms are ongoing, then thinking about going on to more investigations.
Absolutely. So if the headache is their primary symptom, initially,
sort of
and explaining to the patient that this is going to take time and they have to forcibly enforce bed rest at home, seeing them back after some time. And no patient is going to be completely better. Yeah. I think we've got to make that absolutely clear. But if they find that they are better getting up and, you know, feeling a bit better and walking around more easily, etc., you can actually allow a conservative approach to carry on. But if they are not, at that point, consider investigations.
And I think actually listening to all that, we probably don't. I always think the same is true of pneumonia. We don't say, people just think they're going to get some antibiotics and get them instantly better. And they know that they go back to their GP or come back because they're not better after a week when the antibiotics finish. And it's the same thing with an LP, isn't it? It's communication.
A bit of a spanner in the works here, Vicky, is that even after we successfully treat low CSF pressure in the subject, many patients continue to be headachy. So the problem here is that after the initial few, I'm going to roughly guess days to weeks, because this, you know, headaches cease, they stop being a true marker of the pressure situation, because even after you treat that. And how do we know that? We actually find that scans get better, and so on. But patients continue to be headachy. So that is why ongoing headaches in a patient who's had low CSF pressure or even high CSF pressure in the past is no longer a surprise. We don't always consider that the pressure situation is still a problem just because they have ongoing headaches. In high pressure, we go completely by ophthalmology. Papilledema, Sixtner palsy, visual fields.
Yeah.
In low pressure, it's a bit more difficult because, you know, the symptoms might carry on, scans might still remain a bit iffy, you know, and that's where you do need, you know, a discussion and sort of more MDT involvement.
Yeah. Right.
The modern day thinking is very much that you try and actively find a site of the leak in these chronic people, but don't be surprised if you don't find one.
Can I ask a question going back to what you mentioned before?
Yes.
Post-LP, is that there's no evidence that lying down prevents a low-pressure headache? Right. And do correct me if I'm wrong, because I know in our same-day emergency care, we often utilise a room for lumbar puncture and then the patient's in that room for 2 hours lying down. So there's no evidence of that.
No.
We can just put them back in the waiting room with a jug.
Yeah, you need that room, Peter.
Yeah, no, yes, exactly.
So there's no evidence that lying a patient down. So the only things that predicted, you know, the low CSF pressure is the gauge of the needle. So the bigger the needle you use, the more likely you're going to have a low pressure one. So always try and choose the thinnest gauge as possible. Multiple attempts or multiple punctures, especially, you know, sometimes you get people where it's technically difficult and, you know, people go through all that. Beyond that, nothing much else predicted the occurrence of it. As a practical means, what I tell patients who I'm teaming up for a lumbar puncture is that make sure you're well hydrated pre and post. Okay, anticipate that there'll be some worsening of headaches. Doesn't always have to be low pressure. And then manage it, you know, quite appropriately, because you don't want to go down the route of regular codeine, all that sort of thing, which then brings about almost a chronic headache system. And over here in our day case, after the procedure, the patient relaxes in one of these recliner chairs for an hour or so. And if they are well, we'll send them home.
That's good to know.
Shall we move on to our first case then?
Yeah, shall we? Okay. So let's say there's a 26-year-old female who attends A&E with a severe unilateral headache. She's lying down in a dark cubicle when you can see, and she's been vomiting several times. Initially, it started with flashing lights over her left eye, and then her headache progressed. She's lying very still, and she feels nauseated. She's got no other past medical history, but she does tell you that she is on the pill. I think migraines are probably the most common cause of a headache that we see in the acute medical unit. What kind of things make this a typical migraine?
So this is somebody who has got a previous history, or this is a brand new one from you?
Brand new.
Okay. Yeah. So you're quite right. Migraine is the most common, a severe or acute headache disorder that presents through. So if you look at the epidemiology of migraine, we currently estimate that, 20 to 30 out of 100 people walking past this hospital will probably be migraine sufferers. So just from the fact that it is the most common headache, primary headache disorder itself is your main thing. But in this, there are many other more features. Women do have a higher incidence of migraine. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's always migraine in women and or always cluster in men. It's always the story that gives us the diagnosis. Now, the aura that she describes, I'm using the term aura. So let's say the visual disturbance that she describes. I think we have to be very, very careful to take a very good history here. So there are many patients who describe words like, I had blurring of vision, or I have black spots in front of my eyes. And they use that to, quantify their visual disturbance. Having black spots is not necessarily a defined aura of migraine. Many, many people get that. Just getting a feeling of blurring or a pressure behind the eyes also, we can't take it as very defined aura, though a high number of migraines will get that. Aura technically has to be a spreading visual disturbance. And the typical story that people will say is it starts off as a little circle in the middle of one eye. In this case, let's say the left eye. And I invariably ask them, what is a circle? And most people will say it's dark, but it's got sparkly bits on the outside. And then that aura will spread gradually. So between anything from 5 minutes to 40 minutes, you'll have a more of a spreading sensation. It can cross from one side to another. So that is the most crucial bit of our history of aura, where there is a developing set of neurological symptoms, not just with visual. If you get people with sensory as well, they'll say, initially, I got the visual disturbance, then my cheek went numb and my lips went numb, and then the tips of my fingers started tingling, then my arm felt heavy. So that sort of progression is very, very typical for migraine aura, and also helps the practitioner to differentiate it between, let's say, a TIA or a stroke, which will be very sudden onset. And then the type of the headache and the accompanying symptoms. So migraine headache can be any type. I think I've got to specify that. We shouldn't, though the typical pain is described as very severe and throbbing, you will get people using different words to describe it, including pressure, tightness, tension, sharp stabbing. It feels like neuralgia. That you always, because a lot of people immediately think that if you get sharp stabbing pains, it is neuralgia. Not at all. Sharp stabbing pains is a very common accompaniment in the scalp of migraine. So I always tell, when I'm teaching, that migraine pain can be any type, moderate to severe in intensity, and the words aching, pressure, throbbing, etc., can all be come under the umbrella of migraine. But the most important, I think, discerning factor is some of the accompanying symptoms. So yes, patients will say that they are sensitive to light, sensitive to movement, etc., but it's the demeanor of the patient wherein, as you describe, they prefer to isolate themselves, almost be in a dark room, not talk to anybody. Most people will have the pillow, the duvet over their head, and they literally cannot function very well. So migraine significantly affects the patient's capacity to function. That is not a psychosomatic disorder or anything. It is technically the behavior that migraine induces in the human being to, retract from the rest of the world almost, and then stay still and not move. Mm-hmm. Many people will just feel queasy. You don't necessarily have to have vomiting, to make the diagnosis of migraine. And people will have combinations of either sensitivity to light, sensitivity to noise, different things. If you ask a migraine patient directly, are you sensitive to light? Most people will actually tell you, no, I'm not. But then if you just observe their demeanor, where most of them sometimes will be covering their eyes, wear dark glasses, and they'll actually just say, oh gosh, the light brings on my attacks. That's how people will usually, you know, they don't think that's being sensitive to light. They actually think that of it as a trigger. But so it's understanding that. So that story that you've described is very well, you know, for migraine with aura. Now, before anybody thinks that aura is necessary to diagnose migraines, only 20% of patients with migraine have aura. The majority of migraineurs just get a moderate to severe headache with no aura. They might have all the other accompanying symptoms, but they need not have aura. So that's also, you know, necessary to keep in mind.
Okay. I believe the converse is true as well. You can have an aura without not much headache.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. It always, you know, really flummoxes people when you have that. Well, how can you have a migraine without a headache? And so the way to go about it is to say that migraine is a syndrome. It's not just a pain condition.
So when we were writing this case, we put in the oral contraceptive pill for a reason.
Oh, yes.
And because I think I remember learning about this and thinking, I wish I'd known about this a bit earlier on in my career. Because if you have migraine with aura and you're on the oral contraceptive, you're supposed to stop the contraceptive. Is that still the same?
So provided it's an oral contraceptive pill with estrogen. Yes, that's right. So the combination of, I think we have to highlight here, the combination migraine with aura in itself doesn't necessarily increase your risk for vascular events, doesn't. Mm-hmm. But if you have migraine with aura and you're on the combined pill, and you have another risk factor like smoking or obesity or hypertension, you unfortunately raise your risk for having an ischemic vascular event. Mm-hmm. And so women with migraine with aura are advised. So this is young women between the ages of 18 and 45 is what this tends to apply to.
I like that definition of young. Okay, fine. Go on, Peter, did you?
No, I was just going to talk about medications for migraine. Yeah. What's your typical cocktail and how to treat
The term cocktail brings about these. But I'm so glad you brought it up, because the main important message is that, so treatment of migraine, any treatment of any headache disorder is three things. Is there a trigger that you can address? What do you do when you are in the severe pain attacks? So what painkiller do you take? How can you prevent future attacks? So that and for every patient who's got a severe migraine, that's even might be just the occasional one, but they might be in a very busy job and might be incapacitating them, versus, you know, even people with chronic migraines, this is a discussion that we would have. So I'll do the pain treatment thing first. So the first rule is that painkiller treatment for headaches is a completely different ballgame to, let's say, pain treatments for other conditions. So if you have a sprained ankle, there'll be rest and take Brufen three times a day and elevate your leg and all that sort of thing. My medical school knowledge still serves me right. But for migraine, it's not like that at all. So I actually ask pharmacists, can you remove the take four times a day or take three times a day from the boxes of paracetamol and Brufen? Because when giving it for migraine, that is not relevant. The current sort of recommendation is that as early as possible in a migraine attack, so soon after the aura, as soon as the pain is building up, you've got to give the appropriate painkiller medication. Now, this could be just a triptan. So triptans, as you know, are, you know, the way I describe to patients is they are painkillers, but they only work in headache because they've got specifically work on the receptors in the trigeminal vascular system. And the earlier you give in a triptan, the better it is going to work. Mm. There are different types of triptan. Everybody's familiar with sumatriptan because it's been around for 30 years and, you know, we've got different formulations. And there is also a generic version of it available. But you have to remember that sumatriptan, zolmitriptan, rizatriptan, they're all quick-acting triptans. They get into your system very quickly and they last for maybe 3 or 4 hours. But there are other intermediate and long-acting triptans, naratriptan, elatriptan, fovartriptan, which take a bit longer to get into your system but last for longer. So how you decide on which triptan is to figure out, just describe your last two or three attacks. You sort of know how quickly does the pain rise, how long does it last for. And for some people, you need the very quick relief. Some people have the slow building migraines where they might be able to take something, you know, intermediate. Just because you don't respond to one triptan doesn't mean that you won't respond to another. So you might have to use a couple of different triptans to find the formulation that suits the person. So the more effective way we now understand is that you combine triptan with either paracetamol or, if there's no contraindication, a non-steroidal. And you, if necessary, you add in an antiemetic. Now, the antiemetic is not just if the patient is actively vomiting. We do think that there is some degree of gut dysmotility that happens in a migraine attack. And very often the metoclopramide, if there's no contraindications, or cytisine will help. So what we recommend is sort of for an acute severe migraine, somebody like this in A&E, is a triple therapy, a triptan of an appropriate type. There are, you know, there's injections, there are nasal sprays, there's things that dissolve under the tongue, paracetamol or a non-steroidal, plus an antiemetic, which can be given parenterally if needed. The earliest you give in an attack, the better it'll work. The more long, you know, you take, give it much later on, the less likely it'll work. And then you have to tell the patient very clearly, there's no point in repeating these things regularly. You can use it maybe one more time in an attack, but having TDS, QDS, paracetamol and brufen, unfortunately, is not going to help. Right. So one of the buzzwords I tell patients is migraine pain medications work best the earliest in the attack. After that, you know, repeatedly taking pain medications actually for the dull, muzzy headache is actually of no benefit. And you're probably much better off using, you know, more topical therapy. So people find, you know, application of cold, sometimes the sort of cool gel packages, the menthol rubs and all that, though it might all seem rather trivial to the patient who's, you know, in the severe pain, that's better than popping more paracetamol. And as everyone should widely know, the use of codeine and opiates is not permitted in the management of acute severe migraine. Even if it is given for a very severe attack as a one-off, it shouldn't make its way into the prescription or the TTO after that.
Sure. Okay. Would you ever give codeine or morphine-based medicines for other types of headache other than migraine?
So we sometimes get the situation when, you know, if you have a patient with a thunderclap headache and you're waiting investigations for subarachnoid hemorrhage or, you know, any other vascular investigations and you want to obviously, you know, help with the pain. And I can completely understand that that would be the most appropriate thing because you don't want to go in with a triptan, you don't want to go in with a non-steroidal or aspirin at that stage, etc., until things are delineated. So that's completely understandable. But the main message here is that even if you use these things as a one-off, it should be explained very clearly to the patient that that is for the acute pain control, but not for further regular treatment.
Yeah.
Patients might think, oh, that really worked very well. Can I have some more of that? And, you know, that should be a no-no there.
Okay. And you talked about treatment for acute attacks, and then you mentioned more preventative therapy.
That's right.
So what would you use for the preventative therapy?
So, gosh, luckily now we have got loads of options. You know, in when I was training in neurology, we probably had two options at that point to start off with. And I'm talking, it just shows my age, how old I am for this. But luckily, in the last 20 years, the preventative options have... So broadly, I mean, we've got very clear NICE and BASH guidelines for all of these that we have. You know, tablet oral preventatives and the oral preventatives. Now, I'm just going to quote just rough practical figures here. Will work in approximately 60 to 65% of patients where it's used. You still have got a percentage where it may not work. That doesn't mean that the diagnosis is wrong. We just have to move on to the next lot of preventatives. So, when starting a patient on whichever medication for migraine, you know, whether it is an acute painkiller or a preventative, I first of all have the what I call as a reality check conversation with the patient to say that things will get better, but they will take time. Even for the pain, the acute severe migraine, that lady in your A&E is not going to be pain-free by the time she leaves your A&E. She will leave with still a dull, muzzy headache, still feeling unwell, still feeling nauseous, but she should have that understanding that it's going to get better, you know, slowly. So the preventatives, now, why would you give a preventative? Would you give one after one attack? And it completely depends upon the patient's situation. If the attacks are recurrent and they are frequent, you should certainly consider a preventative. Without doubt, all patients with chronic headache disorders, which is headaches on at least 15 days or more in a month, should be strongly considered for a preventative. In fact, I tell patients that that is the evidence-based treatment for headache. It's not taking painkillers. But then sometimes you get people who just have the 4 or 5 migraines in a year, but those themselves are so devastating to their personal life and their careers that for them, control is very important. So that conversation needs to be had about how do you manage it? Can you manage it just an occasional migraine? Can you manage it just the triple therapy or the triptan and the pain, you know, that sort of thing? Or do you need a preventative? So the current preventatives, we have what I call as almost a hierarchy of treatment. So the oral preventatives, I think you will be familiar with these. So they're the beta blockers, the nortriptyline, amitriptyline group. And then we've got candesartan. And at every point I will tell the patient, blood pressure and migraines and or headaches are not linked. It's just that, you know, the similar medications, they work in different conditions.
So I had a young chap recently, and again, exactly like you described, it was properly disturbing his work.
Yeah.
He'd lost one job and he was frightened he was going to lose another one. And he'd already tried, I think it was propranolol, it hadn't worked.
Yeah.
And I was advised by a very helpful neurologist over the telephone to start candesartan. But because he was a young chap, his blood pressure was 110.
Yeah.
And I was a bit nervous and they were like, no, that's fine. It's fine. It won't lower your blood pressure unless, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, it was brilliant. So I caught up with him 3 months down the line and he'd done really well. So
The effective dose of candesartan for migraine control is between 6 milligrams and 16 milligrams. And I think the young people, they tolerate it very, very well. We always reassure GPs that unlike the older population wherein, you know, they are worried about whether there is some, you know, renal artery atherosclerosis and problems with candesartan and so on, in the younger group who are the more migraine affected group, you are, you know, more likely to get good results. The only, the other than the, you know, the need for being on preventatives, the other thing I always emphasize to patients is that preventatives take time to kick in. There is this expectation again, that if something hasn't worked in 2 weeks, it's going to be useless. But most preventatives, they take more than a month. And that's the other conversation that I have with GPs who understandably give a prescription for 1 month and ask the patient to come back for a review. And I'll tell them, you know, though I recognize your reasons for it, the medication may not have started working. So please don't stop it just because it hasn't worked in 1 month. Patients do get very disappointed and understandably frustrated when we tell them this. But I always tell them, I'm sort of thinking about you long term, you know, how you are going to be at the end of 3 months. And, you know, and whereas, you know, many of these things work. So one note of caution about topiramate, which we had is, you know, good, has good evidence and is on the guidelines as a headache preventative. Just as of August, September 2022, the MHRA have issued a caution about using topiramate in women in childbearing age. So it should clearly not be prescribed to any pregnant women. But in women of childbearing age, unless they are on a very highly effective method of contraception, topiramate should not be prescribed, is the current recommendation. Goes without saying that sodium valproate should not be prescribed to women at all, you know, as such. It can be prescribed to men with migraine, though, again, an MHRA guidance, which requires a bit more clarity. There is going to be more caution again also about the prescription of sodium valproate in men. So what's happened is that the oral preventatives, the numbers are sort of, you know, slightly diminished due to various issues. So primarily it is going to be, you know, the nortriptyline, amitriptyline group, propranolol, candesartan. And then, so if people have used the three preventatives and they've still not worked, then they do require referral into a neurology service. And I choose my words carefully. I do, because we get many letters saying, oh, can this patient be seen in a headache service? And I always emphasize that all neurologists, even if they're not headache specialists, will see patients with headache, because it is such a, you know, it forms 40% of our outpatient work, headache disorders. And that group of patients, provided they're not overusing painkillers, provided they meet the criteria that's laid down by NICE, we will consider them for either the newer CGRP monoclonal antibodies, which are preventatives, and Botox, which is used as a preventative. Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah.
Monoclonal antibodies in migraine.
Yeah, they're in everything now.
They are in everything.
I did
think
this is the one podcast where we wouldn't actually mention it. I think it's pretty wrong. So I guess my only other question with migraine is, actually I've got two, but we'll see if Peter asks on it. So hemiplegic migraine always freaks me out a little bit. It's relatively easy if it's a young patient who's known to have them, who by the time I see them, it's already getting better.
Yeah.
I think anybody would image somebody the first time they come in with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got an older patient, you know, when do you start worrying about these?
Okay. So first of all, I think I've got to also make the point about when do we use the term hemiplegic migraine? Because, you know, if you ask the neurologist, we'll all say that the term hemiplegic migraine is actually used too often for such a relatively rare disorder. Mm. So this comes from, obviously, you know, whether the aura that the patient is getting is sensory, when you wouldn't use the word hemiplegic migraine, or it is actually a true dysfunction of movement.
Mm-hmm.
So many, many patients with sensory aura, the numbness, they will use the word, and my arm felt heavy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We would never use the term hemiplegic migraine to describe that group. And I think that's very important to recognize for lots of reasons. At the end of the day, hemiplegic migraine is a type of complex aura in migraine. But it has got some practical difficulties. If you sort of look at still in the BNF, they'll say that triptans are contraindicated in hemiplegic migraine, which is, these are all, you know, issues that hopefully will, with more evidence and more time, will get sorted out as such, because the likelihood of triptans causing anything significant. Well, we don't administer triptans in aura currently, based on the recommendations that there is this slight risk of vasoconstriction with triptans. But the likelihood of that happening is very, very low to almost never. So going back to the hemiplegic migraine thing, I would say sensory aura, I would advise all practitioners to use the word, this is migraine with aura. And if it is one, you know, zone aura, so if you just got visual, you say migraine with visual aura. If you got migraine with visual and sensory and one more, then it starts becoming slightly more complex. So hemiplegic migraine technically will be the person, you know, has got difficulty in raising the arm, raising the leg. The pattern of weakness does not necessarily follow hemiplegia as that happens after a stroke. So where you get almost a pyramidal pattern of weakness, there in hemiplegic migraine, people have a sort of a global weakness. By that, I mean, it's not just the abductors, extensors of the arm that get affected. You know, they're, and if you have documented that, you're quite right. You image the person in the first instance, if they're young, and beyond that, you treat them exactly that you treat other migraine syndromes. In the older person, if they're presenting for the first time, I would have more worry, because it's very unusual for somebody. Mm. So I would have more worry about a secondary problem. You know, have they had a dissection? Have they had, you know, been a sinus thrombosis, etc. would be what I'd be thinking before I, you know, come to the diagnosis of hemiplegic migraine. Mm. Does that sound
Exactly. Okay. And then my other question was, say you see somebody, maybe a woman around the age of menopause, who gets the migraine for the very first time.
Yes.
You know that can be associated, but when somebody's not had migraines before, then at that stage, would you consider imaging in those patients?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we can't all, you know, sit on this high horse of, you know, oh, don't scan migraines always. Mm-hmm. That is very true in young people. Young people with migraines do not need scans. But that conversation has to be had as to why they don't need scans. Mm-hmm. And some people, and if somebody were to ask me, have I been in a situation where I've scanned a person, a young person with migraine? Of course I have, because mm-hmm. you're sometimes in this situation wherein the patient says, yeah, I understand all of that, but I still feel reassured if I have a scan. And I'll always tell them there is nothing called a scan for reassurance, because we actually pick up incidental findings yes. on yes. scans. Yeah. And so I end up having a huge sort of discussion with the patient saying, these are the risks of incidental findings. I personally don't think you need a scan, but these are the risks of incidental findings. Are you psychologically prepared to accept that if we find something like that? And I think we have to document that and go in. But generally, mm-hmm. young people don't require that. But if an older person is presenting, and again, you know, the definition of old is so you're quite, so somebody, you know, beyond the age of 50 or around the 50s and getting an attack for the first time, it's completely understandable that they have a, you know, one-off imaging. And it's the pattern that gives us the diagnosis, isn't it? If you look at the International Headache Society's criteria for diagnosing most headache disorders, they will say 5 or more attacks following the pattern. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the first attack of, let's say, you know, the there are types of migraines that are associated with exertion, sexual intercourse. You do need to image them the first time, but when it happens mm-hmm. recurrently, you yeah. know that it is a primary headache disorder. Okay.
So I'm sat here with a lovely cup of tea and listening back through the headache podcast that Peter and I did with Anita. And one of the biggest decisions we had was, do we split our episode into two? And as you can probably tell with me chatting through now, the answer was yes. Talking to Anita about headache is just fantastic, and pretty much every sentence is an incredible pearl of wisdom. And listening through now, I've picked up more than I did when I was talking to her at the time, and I'm sure as I listen again, I'll pick up more again. So we decided to split this episode into two. As you've just heard, we've talked there about headache in general, covered a lot about migraine, and also sweetened a little bit about low pressure headaches as well. We're going to end the episode there, but we will be back for part two. And in part two, what you've got to look forward to is thunderclap headache, when to do that LP, when to do if the CT's been done early, and what are the differentials, which always gets us when everything's come back as normal. And we'll also be talking a little bit on some of those rarer headache syndromes that we do see as well. So thanks very much for listening to this episode, and hopefully we'll join you for part two.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Society of Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You'll also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod. Let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you would love to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.